BRS meeting, October 10th, 2017.
The bus rail subcommittee meeting, Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. My name is Ed McAtee. I'm the vice chair for the bus rail subcommittee and also advocate for Fairfax County. Somewhere in Upton, starting in my way.
I'm Herb Traeger. I'm the Alexandria rep. And let's see, do you want my second vice chair or something like that?
Yes.
Thank you. Second vice chair. Hello, I'm Anthony Over, Arlington representative.
Mary Kay McMahon, Washington, D.C. The biggest room, the super room.
Single tracking.
so it simply wasn't due because we didn't know the fact. So what's happening now, due to changes that were made October 8th, last weekend, then some of you might have noticed it, was that we've got predictions in there now. And the predictions are when we think, what we think is our best guess about when the train is actually going to be coming, coupled with the fact that about 3 weeks ago, we did update the data on which tracks the trains actually were on in a time of single tracking, so that we knew which side of the track that you would need to go to. Unfortunately, most of the apps did not pick up that first enhancement, even though we told them about it on the developer website. Now that the new data is available through the developer, through the API, I noticed myself over the weekend, starting October 8th, that the API was showing when there was signal tracking, when there were delays, when there were unusual events going. Also, what it's doing now is showing you at terminal stations, in the lines like Huntington, Greenbelt, Largo, whatever, it's showing you when the train is going to depart, which also hadn't been happening in any of the Hensel lines before, and it hadn't been happening until sometimes a minute before at the next station from the end of the line. For example, get on at Gary Place in the evening like I do, and go on the old line to my front end, well, the train started from Mount Vernon. So it doesn't appear on the good at Gary Place until actually the same time the front lights had lasted 1 minute before. So that prediction is updated, and I noticed that data was there yesterday when I was at Gary Place over on the holiday hours. So there's some real upgrades there on the API, and fortunately, I hope then that we'll still be developing even better predictions, which is what they're trying to do. But what you need to realize, we don't have control over how the apps choose to use the data. We can only control what's on the PID. I was told by them, this is not an endorsement, but that Metro Hero app, which is available only on Android, does pick up this new data. And I checked it online, so I can't check it on that. They don't have an Android phone. It was there on Metro Hero. And I think so many other apps are done. So that's the API issue that I looked into. The main issues on the 7,000 series trains that I was asked to look at were, I think, announcements. People were still reporting that on the new 7,000 trains, the announcements were being cut short when the door was closed by the operator before the station announcement, the next station announcement plays. I felt so very run down myself for the last couple weekends. But it typically happens when there is low ridership, like on a weekend or evening, because everybody gets aboard before the whole announcement plays, so the operator just wants to move on and close the door. And if you're like me and you're standing there waiting to hear if this is the train you want or not, they close the door before you find out. You never find out because they're off. So they updated the announcement to the operators, enhanced this announcement to wait for the announcement to play. That is their instruction now. That's the standard operating procedure. They're supposed to wait it out. And then their supervisors are now monitoring the compliance of this. So I have noticed improvement with it since I talked to the people at Rail about this. And I'm hoping that we can still keep improving on that. The other issue that was raised was the announcement of left and right side door openings. That currently is medical policy, and that is also due to our inquiry. Another update that's gone around to the operators, and the rail supervisors are monitoring that again too. So we're trying to correct this and make sure that everybody's adhering to the standard operating procedures. We're getting some helpful cooperation from rail in
accept and as an update to remind everybody. Those were the issues that I had. Does anybody have any questions about those issues or new issues? Satisfied, Bill? Bill here?
No.
Steve, or the, okay, Steve Cat. Yes, Steve.
I'm very sorry. It's so important. I didn't entirely get the conclusion with respect to the announcements. I heard you said it's policy, and so therefore should be followed. Could you just remind me of the issue that that resulted in this look into by yourself?
So the issue is primarily raised by the blind and visually impaired community because it can't read what's outside of the train or what train is next, which train is arriving. So the door opening announcements are important for them, and also when they're in the train to know whether to get out on left or right sides. Sometimes you've got to fight your way to the doors and plenty of time, and you need to be positioned in front of the correct door to get out. So that's the issue. And it is standard operating procedure. It's always been to announce whether the doors are open on the right or left. And it was observed that that had fallen by the wayside somewhat with the new 7000 series trains because that wasn't in the automated announcement. So the operators, I suppose, we had to do automated announcement then.
Was there a question regarding the sequence? I know that it was an IT programming issue that, with respect to the sequence of information when the doors open, that, some people are waiting for information relating to the station and the train itself. What comes first is the announcement to move in and move out. Was that part of the, is that resolved as just something that's an IT thing, or is that still a question?
Well, I don't, that wasn't an immediate question from the previous meetings.
Okay.
That is an old issue that I recall. I think they are still considering that, but I don't think there's a change in the near future. Is that correct, Mr. Premier?
They're looking at it. That is an issue that was brought up by a prior member of the AAC. And on the operating side, the operating team is resistant to change because they believe door opening is a safety message as much as anything else, and they believe that needs to be first, whereas the customers are saying they want to know what station they're at. Right. Now, of course, and they're trying to figure out the balance, because the customers in this case, while it could be any customer, because they're not paying attention, you don't know what station you're at, but they're saying we have one segment of customers with blind and low vision that we're trying to address, and we have to figure out a way, and we have the overall ridership, including customers with blind and low vision, with the safety message. So this has been going on for a bit, and I don't have a anticipated data conclusion just yet as to what the final decision will be. But right now, you can say the decision is to remain as is, although they haven't, no one said that's going to be it forever and ever. So they kind of turned as the AAC is awaiting that, and then new issues, i.e. the left or right announcement, manual announcement by the driver has come up. That has kind of gone to the top of the review ledger, whereas the other issue has kind of gone down a little bit.
Was there a question raised at one point regarding that long announcement that precedes other information relating to step into the middle lasts about 7 seconds before the actual station information is presented, and whether that was needed or whether the station information could perhaps be presented before then, so that people who needed to know had that information before the 7 second long statement was made. Did that ever come up as a question?
Well, I have to check on that again. I do not. And you hear these announcements so much, so don't quote me if I'm, get mad at me if I'm wrong. I did not believe the issue was please move to the center, or the general language came before the station. I thought the whole issue always was the station did come after doors opening, but by then it was too late in some cases. But let me double check on that. I don't remember, because that I think we could have probably advocated a little more of a change more quickly, because step to the middle would be a lot less important than the station itself. So I don't remember that being the sequence, but I'll listen tonight for sure just to hear it again.
Frank, that door is. Anything else?
I haven't heard your entire story, but I do want the end piece. I do want to comment on just that piece. I have been observing the policy change and what we're going to be doing for the future, and I know the issues. But the piece about deaf people and having that announcement specifically for when the doors are closing, so that we know when the doors are closing, I think that's very important, right? And I think that you also mentioned about deaf people having access, right? Deaf blind people as well, and how they hear and how they get the announcement. It's very important. And so I just want to make sure that we think about that as well.
Do you have a proposal or idea about how to make that better?
Sorry, can you just repeat that, please?
Do you have a proposal or idea how to make that better?
Yeah, I think I want to make sure there's enough light that, you know, not just the doors opening, but the lights are flashing on and off to make sure that everyone in the car is aware. I think that also Randy has suggested an idea, and also, you know, I'm deaf. And so having those doors open and then having those lights go off is a wonderful warning that the lights are about, that the doors are about to close, or the doors are about to open.
That's interesting. We'll talk about that. Thank you.
So, we're doing, looking at that for the next month, looking into it. Are there?
Yes, yes.
Oh, I'm sorry, I'm listening.
Will you be looking into that for the next month?
We'll look into it, yeah, we'll look into it for the next month.
All right, thank you very much.
No problem, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, could I have a few more members with their hands up?
Oh, they're very sorry.
Mr. Chairman. Ms. Brooks.
Okay, Mary Kay.
I just had a question about lengthening gaps between buses during rush hour that I use. These are the L buses in the morning going toward into town, and there's frequently a 20 or 25 minute gap between buses. And I just wondered if that was intended, or there was some way to, because I'm fairly close to the beginning of the route, it doesn't seem like one of them should be behind that much at that point. I wondered if someone could look into that.
Yes, I think David should look into the specific bus route. I would say that, have you noticed this change since the overall changes we made, or has it just been enough?
It's been, for instance, more recent than, I mean, it didn't start with SafeTrack. It's only been the last couple of months.
Right, well, that's what I'm getting at. I believe that this is probably the new norm. I mean, we're going to double check it, but spacing out buses, adding headway, was part of the overall changes. I don't know about your specific bus route. We will look research that and report back. But I have a feeling this might be the new norm for that particular route if it happened. Like you said, maybe about 2 months ago when the fare increase went into effect and the other changes, larger headways for some bus routes was part of that overall change as well.
It just seemed long for rush hour.
Well, let me know the bus route because I can check on that.
I'll do that. Thank you.
Yeah, two questions in terms of the issue with the death in line, in terms of knowing the station you're at. Is there some type of light sequence that you could develop for us death in line to let us know when to get on and or off the train? Second question is bus ride. It takes me even longer now to get to work than it did before. That service at the Southern Avenue station is horrible. It's scary.
You're going to say the gaps in the W4?
Yes, gaps in the W14. And then having to get off the train at Southern Avenue to get the 14 to get to my stop. It's quite an adventure.
All right, I'll look at that.
I was cornered in my building a few weeks ago. I just want to pass something along. It may not even be an issue. I was cornered by three people who happen to be seniors, and they asked me, because they know I'm on the committee, they said, why is our fare increase paying for music? And, I ride the bus most frequently, and so I had to head off to the station myself to see, to hear the music, and it's pleasant. there may be a safety issue that should be looked at if this is going to be expanded. My experience was, if you're listening to music, you're less focused on being safe, watching your property, in particular cell phones, which are, especially with the Wi-Fi-ing of the metro system and other property, and also on hearing emergency calls of others. And I had trouble hearing the actual announcements because of the combination of the echo and the added noise coming from the music. I know there were announcements interspersed with the music, and they were probably important, but I had difficulty hearing them just because of the nature of the station being in kind of an echo chamber, and trains coming back and forth.
Where is it coming from?
The PA system. So I can just tell you, for your neighbor's answer, the fare increase is not paying for the music. Let's put that on the record. But I'm just reading a quote from my colleagues who are doing this. Easy listening playlist selected by Metro staff is being pumped into the stations through the PA system to improve the Metro experience. So this is just another effort to say, this is a nice train ride. I mean, I hear you on the safety issue, and we can certainly raise it and just say, someone has brought this to our attention. Did we consider this as we have attempted and with good faith to add some pleasantries to the customer's traveling experience? I think that's a fair question. We can respond to you next month on that. But it is designed, when we first did it, of course, we heard back, just give me a good ride and we get on time. We don't have to go through these gimmicks, as somebody called it. But this is just an effort by an agency, a company, if you will. We're company, and we're trying to just bring a more pleasant experience to our customers. And that's what this effort is all about.
Let me add to it, too. Seeing that there is a safety element to it, because when they did this at Mustard's, they showed that there was a 30% decrease in crime due to playing music in there, too. Of course, they use classical music, do a little class here and there. Because it's been under study that I've read about the time that do this, that show that this kind of music produces crime significantly.
Thank you.
You know, a pleasurable experience on the metro rail bus or whatever, getting there on time, let the bus or the train come and speed in there, and I don't have any inconvenience. And I know where I'm getting on and off at. I'm kind of like torn too, because the other thing that I see is a lot. I see all these new cameras on the buses. Did you pick them too? A lot of cameras.
Well, the cameras now, that is a safety issue, and we want to use it to help protect our customers from those who would engage in behavior that's not right, and we want to be able to capture those people and identify. But you're right. I mean, your expression is that of a lot of customers' initial reaction to the music. That if you just got the trains running on time, safely and reliably, we don't need this music. We are okay. And there were a handful who, in a roundabout way, I guess, complimented us, saying, with all the delays, this is a pleasant experience than just sitting in a quiet station. So, again, it's marketing, it's outreach, it's an effort, but we didn't raise any fares to pay for this. This is rather a simple effort, if you will.
Yes, I have a couple of questions. First of all, which stations is this music being played in?
Right now, I believe it's only Gallery and Judiciary.
Yeah.
I believe those are the only two.
And on the previous comments, I was trying to understand about the announcements on the train. Don't they say something like, gallery plays, doors opening on the right?
Correct, but that's after it says doors opening. Doors opening is actually first. And that causes a person who doesn't know where they're at, or if you're blind or low vision and necessarily can't see the signs on the walls, you're kind of waiting to hear, am I at my station? And if you wait too long and you're too far away from the door, by the time you get to the door and through the other folks, you miss your exit. So that's what the concern is.
So they can take half a second to say, gallery place, doors open, instead of doors open.
Well, that's the point. The operating folks, and what I was mentioning earlier, they believe that doors opening is a safety message to all customers, and they want the safety message to be first, meaning doors opening so you need to step back a bit or be prepared that people are about to either come in or go out if you're standing near the door. So they're saying that's a safety message, and they don't want to put safety behind location. So that's been the debate, if you will.
Okay. Thanks, Tim.
Okay.
Again. And next on the agenda is shuttle service for planned elevator outage. Mr. Blake.
Yes, and I'll be real quick because I did bring this up last week, and I'll reiterate again what's happening, and I'll answer any questions you may have. And that is, within the next week or so, there's going to be a release of a solicitation, a request for proposals from companies to provide the shuttle service that Metro currently provides whenever there's a planned elevator outage. So right now, for example, Judiciary Square, the elevator on the, what is that, on the Glenmont side has been out for like 3 months for the repair. And this repair, only these repairs occur once every 10 to 12 years or so. Now, there are unplanned outages, of course, and that will still be provided. Shuttle service will still be provided by Metro for those. But these elevator outages, and we have a long schedule of planned elevator outages, instead of having a large Metro bus out there and outside of the station with an outage, we're going to have a smaller wheelchair accessible van operated by a third party. Or at least that's what we're thinking about. That's what the company is considering right now. That's why there'll be an RFP. But there'll be a third party company providing the same service. And the idea behind this is, instead of having a large metro vehicle sitting outside of the station, we want to use those vehicles for outages like SafeTrack and other situations, as well as our core service, our core fixed route service, as opposed to simply waiting at a station and maybe providing trips for 10 to 12 customers per day. We believe for the overall convenience and efficiency of our resources, as well as the convenience for the customers, smaller wheelchair accessible vehicles operated by third parties will provide a better overall use of our resources. So we want the AEC to be aware that this solicitation is coming out, and we want the AEC to read it. If you have any comments, concerns, we're going to be able to take those and answer the questions, and if needed, we will make some adjustments to the RFP. Now, something else has come up since then, so let me just add this before we go to questions. There'll be a second RFP release that's going to sound a lot like this, but it's a little different. Metro is running into some resource issues in terms of some of our larger bus vehicles. So for a period of about 10 days, between the Silver Spring, Transit Center, Tacoma, Metro Station, and Fort Top Bus Station, there's the possibility that there may be a solicitation to help us for a period of 10 days through a third party that will be providing fixed route service for those 10 days. It's going to be called shuttle, but again, it's short term, only a 10-day period, but you may see that come out this week as well because of just some resource challenges we're having. The shuttle service will only make 3 stops. Either if it starts at Silver Spring Transit Center, it'll stop at Tacoma, and stop at Fort Totten, and vice versa. Now, those will be the only 3 stops on this fixed route service. And again, it's only 10 days, but I know you'll be interested in reading it and commenting on any concerns. And I'll make sure gets the information out to you all, so you don't have to go on a scavenger hunt looking for every day to see. As soon as it's out, she will forward it to you all for comment and feedback.
Mr. Trigger.
Thank you very much. I have 2 questions. The first is, how is this shuttle service going to be identified? Those of us who live in the suburbs in Northern Virginia, we will have at least 3 different bus companies at a Metro station. Alexandria and Mandorin Street, we have Fairfax Connector, we have Dash, we have Metrobus. So how is the elevator outage bus going to be identified? That's the first question. And the second question is, again, for some of us suburbanites, at the suburban stations, shuttle vans for condos, apartments, what have you, go to one side of the station, and the buses, the jurisdictional buses, go to a whole different side of the station. So which side of the station am I going to find my shuttle bus on? The shuttle bus side or the Metro bus side?
The shuttle buses will be, while they're operated by third parties, these will be Metro services. So they will be within the sides or the bus bays of Metro or Metro bus vehicles.
Yeah.
And the way we would be identifying them is that we're going to have signage on the front of the vehicles, but also placards or big M's or some other branding on the sides of these privately operated vehicles so that they're clearly being identified as providing Metro service at that time.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Anthony has a question.
Hi, this is Anthony from Arlington. I'll follow up to that question. Is the plan right now to have the shuttle buses be there when the outage is happening, or does a person have to call ahead for that? Is there a designated line to do so?
Okay, so yes, the answer is customers can call ahead, and that's one of the things when I first arrived here, that was one of the big complaints, was the shuttle bus service for these elevator outages. It took too long and just a lot of issues. So I began a process of encouraging customers to call ahead. If you knew you were going to be at the station in 30 minutes, and you know that station had an elevator outage, just go ahead and call. So that by the time you arrive at the station, unless another customer happened to come in between that time and request the service, the shuttle bus would generally be there. So that has helped eliminate a lot of concern. But yes, the bus will be there at the station with the elevator outage unless the bus is going to the other station or is at the other station because it has already provided service to a customer. But yeah, we do have a number. It's 202-962-1825. Everything, if you've used that service, you've used that number before. So everything with the elevator outage shuttle that you experience now is not going to change. Everything's going to remain the same, I should say that way, except you won't be getting on a 40-foot Metro bus by yourself. It'll be more like a van that's wheelchair accessible, much smaller, and in some cases could be more flexible. This is not going to happen a lot, but one example. Well, I'll give you two quick examples of why the smaller vehicles can also help the customer. Gallery Place, for example. The elevator is all the way around on 8th Street, but the only place for a big, large vehicle to park for a long period of time and not interfere with traffic or the other buses is all the way around the corner on, what is that, 9th Street or 8th Street in front of the Verizon Center. Well, with a smaller vehicle, we probably can park the shuttle van closer to the elevator somewhere on each street. Another example is out there at, is it Glenmont? I guess that is Glenmont, where the big 40-foot buses, because the elevators are on two sides of this very busy road. I mean, I tried to cross the street myself, and that was putting my life in jeopardy. So you just can't do it. But the elevator is right across the street, literally. But a 40-foot bus doesn't have enough maneuvering room to go all the way across the street, so now we have to take the person down to the next station. Whereas if you have a small van, we can pick you up on the side where the elevator outage was and just take you right across the street, and you'll be on your way to the next station. So these smaller vehicles will give us some more maneuverability, more flexibility, and hopefully a better customer experience in that regard. But just one last thing, I'll just say also, you will always be able, still be able to ask the station manager for support. And as I said, when the customer was here last week, station managers, even with shuttle service being available, station manager is required to also offer you a more convenient alternative if they know that will get you to where you're eventually trying to go much quicker than the shuttle to the next station. But nothing else is going to change except the vehicle.
Franklin Perez.
So the customer can use to their route, and if there's an outage, then they know the system. But I'm wondering if there is a customer who is from a different city or is not familiar with riding the Metro and they decide to go ahead and use public transportation and find out that there's an outage, is there a way to communicate this information to that customer? Because if they were to get a subscription, it would prolong their trip. So I wonder if there's any way to communicate this or system in place so that they don't have to wait as long.
The answer is yes. And if the customer, now it's a matter of the customer, you know, taking a small bit of initiative, if there's a new customer or even a current customer who lives right here, if you know you're relying on the station elevators, it is beneficial to check our website ahead of time to see if that station, if the elevators at that station are working at that time. Now, planned elevator outages, we have those already planned, they're in the system, so you shouldn't have any problems in that regard. The unscheduled outages, where an elevator just breaks down in the middle of the day, we have to send somebody out to investigate, is this a long-term outage, what's going on? So there's sometimes, there is a gap between an elevator going out unexpectedly and the information going on our website that this station's elevator is out. We're working to keep narrowing that gap. I don't know if we'll ever eliminate it altogether, but we want it to go from very wide gap in terms of time to a very narrow gap in terms of time. But these planned elevator outages, they'll be on the website, and if a customer knows that he or she really depends on the elevators in order to access the rail, it's just good practice to check to see if it's working or not. And also, if a customer happens to get to a station where the elevator is out, they can also, of course, request support from a station manager. Now in some cases, i.e. Judiciary Square, you have to get somebody to ask them to come upstairs for you, but the station manager should be able to provide good information, if not the shuttle service, some other means of quickly getting to your destination. So we want to utilize the knowledge of the station managers as much as possible. But yes, it's on the web, and it's a good practice to check.
Okay, next on the agenda is elevator and escalator performance and maintenance. Presented by Mr. Mitchell Nietzsche, Acting General Superintendent.
Speaking of elevator outages.
Wow,
thanks.
Good afternoon. My name is Mitch Nietzsche, and I'm the General Superintendent of Elevator Escalator. To my right is the Assistant General Superintendent, Dan White. He oversees the maintenance of the elevators and escalators in the system. I might not Ellis is, well, the authority has only 618 escalators, 318 elevators throughout the Metro Rail auspices. And out of those 318 elevators, 78 are revenue-facing elevators that the public interacts with on a daily basis. We have 285 employees, a majority of which perform the service and maintenance on the elevators and escalators. They also support jurisdictional safety inspections. We have a contract group that oversees the rehabilitation or replacement of the elevators and escalators. Currently, there is a contract on the way to replace 100 of the worst-performing elevators in the system. I believe that runs through 2024, and as of last check, I believe we are just a little bit under 50% complete. So we have an entire team doing that. We have a team of engineers that support the rehabilitation and maintenance project. And we have our own internal dispatchers, our OCC, and we now have a remote monitoring facility based in Landover, Maryland. And
when their sole function is to look for applicants before they report. I assume that everybody would want to know what our availability and our maintenance numbers are, so I asked Dan to come along and he can speak to those numbers now.
Good afternoon, everyone. So our elevator availability for September was 97.42%, and year to date it's 96.92%, with a goal being of 97, so we're 0.08% from meeting goal. Mean time to repair for year to date is 6 hours. 6.03 hours, and mean time between fares is 476.5 hours. The goals there are less than 8 hours, which we met for the mean time to repair, and 476.5 hours is less than the goal of greater than 600 hours between fares. That's for the elevators. For the escalators, system availability year to date is 94.35%, and our goal for that is 93.5%. Mean time to repair is 4.9 hours year to date, with a goal of less than 8 hours, and mean time between fares is 176.33 hours, with a goal of greater than 168 hours. So we meet all goals there. That's our availability for elevators and escalators.
Mr. Trigger.
On your elevator monitoring system, could you explain to me a little bit about how it works? You have a remote monitoring system where the elevator is constantly sending information to a center that provides you information on how well it's operating and any anticipated problems. Can you talk about how it works, please?
Correct. The majority of the elevators and escalators in the system are capable to speak with us. They have an IP address, and they send the remote center information that tells it the status, whether it's running up, running down, if it's out of service, and a series of minor faults. So if it is out of service, we have a general idea, in most cases, before the technician arrives, of what the issue is. It doesn't get too detailed, but it gives us a record of that. We have a remote monitor or servicer. It's essentially a dispatcher that looks at that information, and they have a series of validations that they go through to ensure that the elevator or the escalator is really out of service, and then they go through the process of calling the station, informing the station manager, having the station manager try to start it first, and then issue a failure.
Any other questions?
How long does that process take? I mean, I've noticed that there's been escalator outages during the peak times in the morning, especially like foggy bottom.
So, the process really just takes a few minutes, but there's a lot of equipment going on, there's other things going on, so that same group would also, if there was an elevator entrapment, for example, that would take priority, so they kind of essentially taking their focuses of looking at the entire system, but it should take just a few minutes, but you know, occasionally we may miss it. We only have one person at a time during revenue in the middle of the week, so we're not staffed for weekends just yet. We're working on staffing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Right now it's just 5 days a week, mornings and evenings. So there are times that the dispatcher does get a break or have lunch or whatever, and at that time, we try to have a supervisor cover. Dan is working on a plan to populate that room 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we hope that happens actually before the end of the year. But there are gaps in the system, if that's your question.
One How often I see that there is some, has been some redoing, I guess, taking maybe some of the steps out of whatever, replacing them, and I've seen that done on the weekend. That should be pretty cost efficient, isn't it, on the weekend for them to do that?
Is it cost efficient?
Yeah, because I see it done mostly on the weekend, not necessarily during the week.
So I think it's important to understand that on the escalators, it's for the most part we do almost all the maintenance, preventative maintenance, midnight shift, try to be out of the way of the public. Our technicians do work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. They have a set schedule, so most of the times when they work on weekends, it's not an overtime issue, it's not a cost-effective issue to do it on the weekends and not do it on the weekends. Sometimes the supervisor or the superintendent will schedule work to be done on weekends for that reason, because it's normally a lower peak. So there are many different reasons that go into why they make those decisions.
With the elevator monitoring system, does the system then kind of go to a technician carrying a handheld device, or do you actually have to have somebody physically in an operations center?
So currently, once an outage is identified and it's validated, a work order number is generated, and that goes into our service database called Maximo. And it's normally dispatched through supervisors, so the supervisor will see that as soon as it pops up on his screen. And it's normally the supervisor who dispatches the work.
But if an elevator goes down during the weekend, is there somebody there that knows it? Somebody in an operations center that knows it or receives that information on a handheld device?
If an elevator goes out of service on a weekend and the service room is not being if it's closed, there's still an OCC, an elevator desk down in the operations center that will capture that information. When the station manager reports that elevator is out of service, then it goes through the normal channels and it will also appear on the external webpage.
Your operational percentages are pretty good. Is vandalism any problem?
It is. Vandalism is normally prevalent, especially in the summertime. Kids break glass, they break the vision panel glasses, and that happens quite a lot. You could probably answer this question better, but we replace a lot of elevated glass, vision panels, and side glasses.
It's been happening repeatedly, like in Rockville. There was 3 weeks in a row they broke the glass, so we had a contractor come in, and at that time we notified transit police, and we also pulled video to try to get an idea if we can, you know, identify who's doing it. We sent technicians and supervisors out there on midnights specifically to find out if they can, you know, see what's going on.
This is Anthony Albert from Arlington. I just have a quick question about, and hopefully this is the right place to do it, but as far as performance goes, Ed was saying, you have a pretty high rate of in-service elevators. But something that I always find, especially with, for example, La Front Plaza, the way the elevators are set up is difficult for somebody like me who uses a wheelchair to get from one side, the orange line, all the way over to the green belt side. I was wondering if there is a system in place for, you know, someone like me who has difficulty with that or takes an extra time to sort of let you guys know about that and whether or not there's any room for in the future making it more akin to Metro Center or Gallery Place where there's two areas to get to either side of the platform. Does that make sense?
So I understand the question. Are you saying that is there any plans underway to change configuration to make it easier to access how to get from one location at La Font to another?
Partially, and the other part of that was, is there any way for somebody of the public to come to you and say, hey, yes, this is not housed very much, but it's still difficult, you know, is there a...
So, if you don't mind, I'll answer the last part first.
That's fine. That's
so,
fine.
There is a way for the public, I want everybody to know, there's ways for the public to reach us, and we spend a decent amount of time through a third party communicating with the public, either through data or through customer service. So we get a lot of questions why elevators are out, or we actually get a lot of good information from the public because there may be a problem with an elevator that we're unaware of. And sometimes, you know, much like your car or any other appliance you may have, when the repairman shows up, the problem doesn't seem to happen. And we don't know that, so we'll get a call and somebody will say, the doors are not opening long enough. And we get out there and it's working and the technician will check it. And then, you know, a couple hours later you get a funky problem where that's only happening at certain times. And we understand that if you're the person that relies on the elevator, you don't care that it's only happening an hour a week. It happens when you're at that elevator. So a lot of times we get that information through customer service or through data, and we'll send somebody out to investigate it. And I'm gonna be honest with you, sometimes David brought an issue to our attention in Clemont, and it took us a while to find it, but I believe Dan's group finally took care of the problem. So there is a way to communicate with us.
The first question
you asking here?
Yes.
We did look, and this happened actually prior to Mr. Nisi, but we did look and it actually went to the FTA to request money and, you know, just brainstorm, nothing official. But we came up in terms of just LaFont Plaza, because that was a very specific case in which the FTA asked us about, and we showed them a plan, and I think the numbers came out to be about $20 million for new elevators. Challenging problems of private property, because areas where we would put more direct elevators outside of our station into the station that would actually be on private property. There's a lot of challenges. Now, what I'm about to say next is not a lot of comfort in the meantime, but I would say Metro is continuously being proven, and in the numbers Mr. Nisian's team is always providing, shows Metro is probably the most accessible big city transit agency in the nation. However, we didn't get that way from original design. One of the reasons the elevators are kind of all over the place is because there was a commitment later on to do. Now, they were pushed by David and some of his friends, but it's there now. But building in elevators and other vertical entrances and exits into an already existing system is very challenging. So yes, the moving around that you're talking about on the Font Plaza is a challenge. We've talked to the FTA specifically about it because they came to us about that challenge. There is a big price tag with it. There are other challenges beyond money with it. We're looking at always improving, but right now, I don't want you to walk away thinking, one, we're not looking at it, but two, that there's anything right away on the drawing boards, because it's going to be a bit.
No, just for for your own understanding, it's a problem that I know would take a considerable effort to quote-unquote fix, because if nothing is broken, it's just design. And to redesign anything takes time and effort and money and all sorts of other things. To your point about how customers interact, is that through an email or is it through the website?
It could be either way. It could even be through the station manager.
Okay.
So it could be email, phone call, web page, through the station manager. Oh, even social media.
Okay.
We do respond.
So if I can think it, you'll see it. That's about it. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Do we have that customer service link? There is, we get customer service complaints, comments all the time. And I believe it's through the website. I don't know if we can get that link out. I'm not sure how to do that.
Thank you. We can send it out to everybody. We can send it out. Thank you.
Okay, that was an issue.
Thank you, Pat.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the agenda is the emergency exercise discussion. The exercise that went on recently at White Flint Station. Mr. Blake, go ahead.
Now, Mr. Chair, hi. We had two members of the AAC to participate in the emergency exercise at White Flint that happened, I guess, back in August. This is just the first opportunity we were able to get it on the calendar, and that was Mrs. Brooks and Mr. Calabia. They both participated in that, and we thought that they should take some time and just share a bit about their experience.
Tina.
I was what we call a walker. I did not suffer any injury in the simulated exercise. Hazel did that, she'll have more to say, but I must admit to some disappointment about the confusion. And then when the simulation involved injuries, the disregard of the passengers who were injured, disregard by first responders. Maybe Hazel, it's good for you to give your own experience about that. She was one of the simulated injured.
I don't think it started on the map. It's the first thing. They seem to be the whole lot short in terms of getting everybody on to trains and also, explaining what to actually expect from the simulation. I think because they knew it was a simulation, they take it that seriously. The first responders, and there was situations where we had to probably give comfort to people who, in a situation where they would be in a tunnel, in train tunnel, dark. They had dust, simulated smoke. They had a loud noise go off like it was a bomb. So they simulated some scenarios. But for me, not just being a handicapped bike, the point is that I'm in a tunnel and there's bombs going off, smoke, the cars on fire. First thing I went, and the doors was open, the first thing I'm doing, I'm jumping out of the train. I'm going. And I think a lot of people felt that way. You know what I'm saying? I mean, if you talk about a real life experience, that's what people want to do. They want to get out. They don't want to, stay on the train. They want to go. And so I don't think the first responders really understood that aspect of it. And I don't think that they comforted people as well as they could. Like my role was, I had a heart attack. And so, I kept telling my chest is hurting, like, yeah, I was just talking about it. Yeah, your chest is hurting, yeah. Like, come on. In a real life situation, if you took someone who was really actually having chest pains or panic attacks or anxiety attacks, and there was a whole scenario of things that could have happened. Person had a broke leg, person had a limb, injured or whatever. They definitely don't want to be felt as though, they're not, their needs are not being attended to in the manner that the first responders did. And then after they got you out of the car and they put you on, it was kind of like one of those old fashioned, what do you call it?
you know, it's like roll to up the track, you know.
That's called the evacuation car.
Yes. Okay, well, they put you on the car. It's very uncomfortable, by the way. Especially for someone my size. I'm not that big. So, I mean, if you put someone else on there, they had a little bit more weight, I'm sure it'd be very uncomfortable for them on the car. I probably would have felt better walking as opposed to on the car. Once they got you out to on the car, got you all the way up to the point where you could just get off the car, then you went up the escalator in there where you met with the med team. The gentleman I had, he seemed to be a little bit confused about his role in terms of what he needed to ask and the sequence in which he needed to ask it. But at that point, it was quite an interesting simulation. I don't know how they can improve that. I just used to in my history just work with people who've been in really terrible situations and be able to just comfort them in that terrible situation to make them feel better and to, you know, get them out as most expediently as possible and to, get them to safety in a way that made them feel, you know, not like, okay, this is just a simulation, so we really don't have to do anything here. So that's the feeling I got. But, I mean, it was interesting. All in all, I guess with some minor improvements, I guess it's okay.
That communication statement that you guys just made, I think it was done before another jurisdiction where another exercise was held. The same situation where the communications just weren't very good. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes wonder if it's a product of the fact that everybody knows it's an exercise or in real life situation, what would happen. I mean, I don't know.
Well, it certainly was a situation where I think the people who were involved in the exercise meeting and also the people who participated in the meeting put a lot into it in terms of, okay, well, we know this is a simulation, but I just think that they could have made me and some of the other people who had injuries felt better in that instance.
Any other questions?
I just like to add that, we know, especially from disasters that have recently happened, as well as Las Vegas, the first responders do respond, and pacifiers or bystanders do help, which surprised me during the simulation. First responders, maybe who were involved in the simulation for the first time themselves, they just walk past injured people. I couldn't believe how they would just, they almost didn't even look at a person when a person was crying out for help.
Yeah, you had no eye contact.
No, not at all. Well, on the other hand, we do know that first responders really do respond properly.
I think first responders, in a lot of cases, do triage. They determine who's not that injured, who is injured.
Well, a number of the injured were right there, basically. We're in one car, and they disregarded the ball.
Any other comments?
Hello, this is Anthony from Arlington. Just a question about simulation. I wasn't able to go, or I would have. But there were simulated injuries. Was there anyone there, say, in my position using a wheelchair? How did they, even if they weren't designated as injured, how does one in a wheelchair get out? I mean, because I'm not going to be jumping on any train, that'd be doing that much. So I don't know if that was part of, you know, the stipulation. You know, how does one who may be not injured but cannot get out of the train by themselves, how do they deal with that?
So the way it's supposed to work, and Faisal brought up the evacuation cart, is that a person in a mobility device is generally separated from their mobility device at first, often carried or placed on the evacuation cart, and then, for lack of a better word, you're married up with your mobility device at a later place and time when it's safe to do so.
Like when you get on the plane.
Well, yeah, there you go, right. Yeah, I'm going to take an emergency. But no, yeah, we're not talking a plane crash there, okay?
No, okay.
But yeah, so that's the way, and that's in our documents, that's been repeated often. That's what's going to happen. They're going to remove you from your mobility device and either carry you or at least get you to the evacuation cart and move you down the track.
I guess part of my question is also, did that happen in this simulation?
It doesn't sound like it. Now the question is, now they placed Ms. Hazel on the evacuation cart. Ms. Hazel, you said you were supposed to have a heart attack, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe that's why they played this test, she had a heart attack, she can't move. The question is, was there anyone who participated who was in a mobility device? And I think the answer is no.
Not from the AAC. Now, we could have had other volunteers to participate, but from the AAC, we only had two members who participated in this event.
And generally, even though we do open it up to the entire community, including the community of people with disabilities, but if an AAC member doesn't participate, generally speaking, I think I'm not speaking out of turn there, generally speaking, we don't have too many people participating voluntarily who are
not from the disability community.
Correct. So the answer is probably no, but I know it has happened. Now, I don't want to say how great, because I'm hearing concerns, right, and all this would be on the record, but if we could ask Ms. Rush, in her experience, when you've been part of these exercises, were you there as an observer, or did they treat you as a party that needed to be evacuated? And if so, did they separate you from your mobility device as is the actual plan of real emergency?
Yes. It separated. And they charged me
That's another issue. We'll have to continue to get clarification on that. But so they do separate, so we do practice that. But what Ms. Rush is referring to is in the past, there appeared to be a practice or something among some of the, because you know when we talk about first responders, you know, we're talking about people in the jurisdictions, not necessarily Metro staff. And there was this issue that it appeared to be that people with disabilities were being evacuated, at least the mobility device were being evacuated last. Now, we need some clarification more on that. And one thing we've done is encourage each of you in your own jurisdictions as you advocate at meetings and your own other committees. And if the first responders ever appear before your committees, raise this as a question. Is there a policy that people with mobility devices who have to be separated and then carried and placed on the cart, is there an order of importance? Now, what they're going to tell you, what they've always said to us is that they evacuate based on need or injuries. I think it's the term injuries. The most severe injured individuals get evacuated first, regardless of disability or any other circumstance. After that, you're not injured. There's a fire in the tunnel, and you need to evacuate. Is there an order? And each, you know, there are fire departments in every county and these little towns and jurisdictions, and they're all using different policies. So we should continue to ask that question in your own
jurisdictions, as well as we'll continue to raise it. But there's no one hard and fast rule, but the concerns Russia's raised has been one we continue to push.
I wasn't but last because of my mobility device, because I couldn't walk on my own. And they let anyone who could walk out of the room, let out the door on the floor. And I saw him about 30 minutes later. But it wasn't because of the other fights. If you couldn't get off on your own, or you had a visual problem, then you were last.
And yours was in pressure of the sky, right? I was asking her which one did she participate in, Prince George's town?
Virginia.
You were in Virginia.
Oh, she's a good fan.
She's a good quiet. Okay, never mind. Okay.
Hey, Dr. Sigurd, one last thing. You know, it was my first time, and I might have been naive in what I witnessed, but I just now recall there was a trainer who actually trained people and first responders in particular in what to do. She was there as a passenger. I sat next to her. And towards the end, she said she was disappointed in how she organized things for her. So it wasn't just me as a bystander being horrified. She was very disappointed.
That's fair.
Yeah. To get on the record, sort of out there, it sounds like the main issue with the simulation is that first responders and people who are conducting it aren't taking it as seriously as they maybe should have. I can tell you from personal experience and family experience, my father's a fireman. So most departments and most emergency services have what's called a protect in place situation, in which you're supposed to go somewhere to basically be collected. Like, I live on the fourth floor of my building. There is, you call the fire department, you tell them where you are, and they come and get you. Whether that was part of this simulation or no, all fire departments anywhere should know what you mean when you ask if they have a protected place plan. So I think that should be explained a little better. And just as a point of clarification, it shouldn't matter whether it's a simulation or not, I think. You know, my father has told me stories where, you know, part of his job is to test the fire alarms in schools. Well, it defeats the purpose if you have a fire drill and it's announced to the administration and faculty. So you don't announce it. You just show up and you tell them this is what we're doing. You have this month. We're going to show up at some point in this month. So I do hear that concern, and I probably will talk about his thoughts on this, because it's interesting to me that you have a simulation that's designed to show you how it would be in a real situation. It really shouldn't matter that it wasn't real because it was supposed to be real. So I just wanted to get that out there before we conclude this.
Yeah. Yeah, the trainer was very, very, very disappointed. Thank you to reminding me that she was very much concerned about, I guess, how to move the group forward from some of the things that she was noting, you know, that she was writing down, that she was keeping track of.
Mr. Chair, this is V. I just want to share with the members that I believe we're going to have another emergency exercise coming up in November, and I think it's going to be in Virginia. So I will send that out to all the committee and those members that want to sign up or want someone else additional that they know a constituent to follow with to sign up. We'll get it out as soon as they provide that information to me. Thank you.
I don't know if this is supposed to be spontaneous or not, these exercises, but it sounds like you really need coordination between both sides, first responders and the disabled community.
We agree. We've been kind of going around with this, and the AEC has offered a lot of recommendations, and I think if, depending on the date and time of the next exercise, we could certainly invite our, Mr. Bodmer, right? Rob Bodmer? Yes, we can invite them one more time prior to that exercise so that you can express your concerns and desires to see a more realistic and therefore more effective exercise take place.
I think also they should keep an open mind when the first responded rather than this criticism.
That's fair.
Okay. Is that it?
No, that's it on that. We have a couple of quick announcements on appointments. But before we go to that, what was new business? What was that? There's nothing under business? Did anybody, the committee, if they had any business? Well, we'll go ahead and make your appointments, and then we'll go to new business.
Just wanted to share with the committee that the AAC has made its appointments in regards to the new leadership. So your new leadership on the AAC will be, or is, Phil Posner, Denise Rush, the second vice chair, and Elva Reza Silva, who is still at home mending and doing better as the second vice chair. And here your appointments have already been confirmed for the Bus Route Subcommittee. So your new chair of the Bus Route Subcommittee is Ed McEntee. His vice chair would be Tino Palladia, and the second vice chair is Herbert Trieger. So they're already here, but I just wanted to make sure members knew that it was confirmed.
I like your
Well, now it's official again, everybody knows. I also want to share with the committee about the Hettinger Accessibility Excellence Award. You know that's coming up on November the 2nd. Most members should have received their invitation. If you haven't, please let me know. We'll make sure that it gets out to you. Members were to vote on three of the nominations that we have. We have a tie in the nomination process. And so because we have a tie and it is a issue we hadn't come up with, so that means we had really, really good candidates who people had nominated. And so with that, we are trying to determine what's next best to do before we make the announcement. So we counted it all out today and looked over it again. I looked through all the emails to see, to make sure I had every single one that applied. Herb, you had asked me a question about the criteria, which was on the front top of the document. But I just said, okay, he'll see it when he scrolls to the top to see who nominated him. It's very short. What we had done is streamlined the process. And in that streamline, we did not ask for quite a bit of information. And so there wouldn't be like 5 points that you would have to meet. It's only one, and it's on the top of the criteria. So.
Is it too late to vote?
It's too late to vote. It's okay, yes. It'll be, all this will be next year. So. I think you all will get an email probably by tomorrow to tell you all who has been selected and how we're going to break this tie. So just wanted to let everyone know. Any questions?
You said three. I thought there were four.
There were three because what we had was one person was nominated twice by two separate people. So they don't go on twice. They're just the same person. So that gave three people to be nominated that you could vote for. Yes, Mr. Kalecki?
Can I add consideration? You know, as a brand new member, I've been trying to do my homework. And I find myself learning a lot from our local journalists. A person like Mark McCarroll of WAMU or Free Speak, the Post, and there's another reporter. Is there any possibility that maybe a special award could be made, not this year, but in future years, to recognize the journalists who do the coverage, who provide information, who in some sense almost seem as advocates on our behalf, they deserve to be honored. And it might help even other journalists to hear about this, to be sensitive to our needs and to help in publicizing the kinds of goals that we have and the problems that we face. So I just want to offer that as a suggestion for consideration.
Absolutely, and we could definitely include that in our lessons learned suggestion box for next year. Thank you, sir. Yes, sir.
I'd just like to add a plug for Martin DeCaro, because when I chained myself to a tree several years back, he interviewed me to stop the freeway from being constructed. I'm sort of joking, but not really. He did interview me three times for WAMU, and he's very personable and a very good interviewer. And just made me feel completely comfortable as I'm standing there chained to a tree.
Nice. I'm glad you clarified that it was more than just being chained to a tree. Absolutely. Okay. Yes, Denise?
I guess I've been really reading a lot of things, but I'm confused because I thought that before I still asked that because I thought it was the Ark of Virginia.
The Ark of Northern Virginia. We had the Honorable Catherine Hudgens,
yes.
We had Catherine Hudgens and Denise Rush.
But,
I'm sorry, National Federation of the Blind. Right, but Catherine Hudgens was twice, that's why I thought that.
So isn't that four?
That is four.
Okay,
I'm sorry, yeah, I just thought of I knew Catherine Hudgens was on there twice, but yeah, that was four, but we had a tie.
Okay.
That's it for me.
New business.
This is quasi old business. You'll remember in September, both at the full Access Advisory Committee meeting and also at our meeting last month at the Bus and Rail Subcommittee. Mr. Dan Stevens appeared both times and discussed his request to build a bus station near Riding Center, where his 19-year-old daughter, who has a slight mental disability, was using the center in a therapeutic way and didn't have a safe place to get off except for the goodness of some of the bus operators. Both Charlie Crawford and I attended a meeting in Montgomery County in which Mr. Stevens came and brought the attention of the mobility manager of Montgomery County and some of her group discussed it. And during the discussion, there happened to be a Montgomery County Department of Transportation official, and he mentioned that he saw the problem, he would bring it back to the office. Well, I checked last week, both with the official and with Mr. Dan Stevens, and apparently the matter is moot because the horse riding center is being sold and closed in January. But he was very grateful for the efforts that we made to try and obtain what was needed for his daughter, who's mentioned to see.
Thank you. This is just a follow-up business about the Sinking Metro Station at Reddick Road, and there was a second one. Have the ramps been built for wheelchair accessibility onto the from the platform on into the train?
Herbert, which station was it?
It was Reddick Road and
Rhode
Island Avenue. Yes. Right.
So let's just be clear: we're not building ramps yet, but we have placed on platform signage to indicate the optimal boarding areas. And that has been completed at both Braddock Road and Rhode Island. So when you go out there, and they're going to be complimented, the website was a little delayed, but now it has been updated. You can go online to hear it, but also, and to read it, of course, but also when you're out there on the platform, you will see in that case, visual customers can see the yellow placards on the platform indicating these are the most optimal areas to board
at those particular stations.
Thank you very much.
Denise.
This is new business. Someone called me about notification of the last trains every day. Is there a notice where you can find out when she got to the metro station and her car was parked in another station? And
notification of last train. How will we add that to the ombudsman follow up list? I mean, I'll look into it, of course.
Yeah, when is the last train for each
station? I mean, that's a good question.
For each station, you can find that information at the station manager's booth. So you can ask the station manager, but if you're sighted, then you can see it's listed at the station manager's booth. And some stations have new signs, so it's like a red and white sign now. It used to be a different color. Also, on our website, when you look up information about the station, it tells you on our website, under that station, the last train for that station in that direction. So you have to make sure you know the direction you're going to for the last train, because it could be different in certain directions of the train.
So
it's
on the train.
It's in the trip planner, too.
David says it's in the trip planner as well.
Yeah. All right.
First and last train, third, two of your options. Sure.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Are there any more?
Charlie Crawford.
Okay.
Crawford has one last question.
Thank you. I wonder if it's possible to know, I feel kind of stupid asking this question because I really didn't realize that the voting for the Hettinger thing was over. So I hadn't voted. And I was hoping to vote because I had a particular candidate in mind that I felt should win. But I don't know how many people did not vote. Am I the only one that didn't vote?
Yeah, I did not either.
I did not.
First correct.
I think the majority of members did not vote.
Three or four.
Right. I think that's the issue.
Because there were rules on the deadline.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there was a deadline. So here's my question. This one's in your hands. You know, I saw the trouble I got in with this fellow being on the way to handle the. No, that was good. I think that worked out, and that's how we've been doing it. But those elections, and I'm kind of a stickler on those because they're handled within the bylaws, and the positions are bylaw-related positions. This is the AAC's award. And I know we want to keep our business going. We have work to do, and we don't want to keep extending deadlines. But this isn't, the Hettinger isn't necessarily in the AEC bylaws. And there appears to be, for whatever reason, a lack of participation on the original round. I mean, is there any harm in allowing the members who haven't voted another 2 or 3 days?
We can't do another 2 or 3 days because we have to order the plaques and awards. But, I mean, I'll send it out, but everyone has to do it tonight because I got to do it by tomorrow at 10.
Gotcha. So tomorrow at 10 o'clock.
I'll send it out again tonight with a tomorrow at 10 for everyone to do it. And no, you can't tell me, Ms. Felipe, you got to actually email it.
I haven't voted.
If you voted, then I have your information. Oh, you.
I was late, but now I'll be on time.
Okay. No problem. But I'll send it out this afternoon, this evening, and then. Please just send it to me tomorrow by 10, because again, we have to order.
Yes.
And this is only for the people who have not voted. So you're only notifying the members who have not voted, correct?
Correct.
Yes, I'll send just to the members who have not voted.
That's correct.
Herbert, yes.
Where are the criteria?
Flip to your very first page where people talk about the nomination. Who's nominated?
Nominated.
I'll come over.
Yeah, please.
So we can clear. Okay, so if anything else on the agenda, move to adjourn.
Before we adjourn, and it may not be germane just to this committee, But the ride-along project, which involves ACC members accompanying other board members on either the bus or rail, is there going to be any guidance or discussion of that?
The AAC Travel Initiative is what you're asking about, Mr. Galavia?
Yes.
Yes, okay, so the information has been forwarded to the board secretary. They have confirmed one actual trip. So, Anthony, your trip has been confirmed with your board member. But I am waiting for the other member, the other board members to confirm. Once your member confirms, you'll get additional information. What we're trying to do now with another board member, if by chance the dates don't match up, because we have a schedule conflict with another board member who wants to participate, and that's not workable for you, we're trying to work it out for another member. But we're sending that information at the time, and the board already knows, and they're trying to work their schedule. But we're working it out, and we haven't forgot about it. If you have any questions about it, don't hesitate to just shoot me an email or give me a call.
I think Anthony has a question.
Anthony? No.
Okay. Move to adjourn.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.